Good afternoon, and welcome to the June 6th edition of Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet, and I'm here in the studio with Alex the intern. Patty, I think, is on her way. Laurent is homesick with the baby. He has a one-and-a-half-year-old who apparently just on a Sunday, she knows he works. Anyway, you can friend us on Facebook and download podcasts of the show at lambdaweekly.com. And our guest today is Scott Herring, author of Another Country, Queer Anti-Urbanism. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good. Okay, we can hear you. Tell us a little bit about just the premise of your book. What is anti-urbanism?
Anti-urbanism. I'm sorry. The connection.
Yeah, the connection. The connection is a little fuzzy. Do you want to try it again on the other phone that you said you had?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and give you a call on the other phone.
Very good.
Good.
And in the meantime, Alex and I will just chat a little bit. So give us a call back, okay?
Great. Thanks.
Very good. Thanks. And Alex.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I know. How was your week?
It was good.
What gay things did you do this week?
I didn't do any good gay things, unfortunately.
Ah, okay. Well,
did you?
It just worked.
Well, yeah, that's a daily gay thing. Really.
Yeah, I know it is. One of the things that I did this week, and somebody I wanted to get as a guest, but I'm going to mention him. One of the things that we did that I wrote about this week was okay.
Hello.
Yeah, you're there.
Great. Okay. Thanks.
Much better connection. Okay. Much better connection. Alex, before the end of the show, remind me I started talking about something that I wrote about this week, and we'll talk about it by the end of the show. Patty, your copy of the book is right there. Give us just a little bit about what is Another Country? What is anti-urbanism?
Sure. I've been working on the book for about 6 to 7 years, and my primary focus was extending some recent scholarship that's come out about focusing on the value and validity of rural gays across America. And what I was most interested in was thinking about the ways in which these rural lesbians and gays try to sort of negotiate the desire, the demand to move to quote-unquote big cities. And so I thought about thinking about what does it mean to have a really livable life in a non-urban environment, and to think about the value and the pleasures and the vitality that can be found for lesbians, gays, LGBTQ population living in non-metropolitan environment. And it's titled Another Country.
Okay, but your introduction starts, your introduction is actually titled I Hate New York. Okay, now, are you from New York? I'm from New York originally. Are you from New York? Have you lived in New York?
No, I haven't lived in New York. I've visited quite a few times, and I have to say that the introduction, as I hope it came across through you and to your other readers, is meant to be just a wee bit tongue-in-cheek. I think that tone of irony and sort of ambivalence comes out throughout it. And so I was just sort of thinking about, in terms of what does New York City mean for American lesbian and gay populations, as a sort of idealized space, or as I was there last year, a sort of make the rainbow pilgrimage for gay pride to the city.
Uh-huh.
And I started thinking about all those other spaces that don't get a sort of sense of rainbow pilgrimage, and how do they think of themselves in relationship to New York, which often gets figured as a sort of promised land.
You know,
and so that was my ambivalence.
Yeah, and it's funny because you're talking about New York in particular, and that applies to Los Angeles, it applies to San Francisco, especially San Francisco also, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the pleasures in writing this book was to sort of track how that idea of New York, San Francisco, L.A. as the sort of epicenters of American lesbian and gay population came about. And so, for instance, in my second chapter, I look at what one very brilliant anthropologist calls the, quote, great gay migration of the 1970s to these spaces. But I was also interested in thinking about lesbians and gays who didn't or couldn't make these migrations as easily as others, mm-hmm. and how did they respond to this growing pressure, might be too hard a word, but this growing desire to participate in these densely concentrated urban centers.
Well, and actually you do start in that chapter talking about three people who did migrate to New York. One of them is Willa Cather. One of them was Charles DeMuth, who's a an artist, but also a writer. And another one, James Weldon Johnson. How did they react to New York? One of the things that you say in your book is that what they did was, or what we're doing now in New York, is there are these big gay history tours, and of course they're featured prominently, but they didn't really care for New York.
Yeah, absolutely. The move to San Francisco and New York that I was talking about occurred probably in the 1960s. But you're absolutely right that I wanted to sort of push it as far back to sort of the beginnings, or sort of like the quickening of lesbian and gay identities in America at the turn of the 20th century. And so this was already going about as a global phenomenon in Paris and in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And New York City, as several social historians have shown, Chicago as well, became the sort of ground zero, so to speak, of lesbian and gay community formation and subculture. Mm-hmm. And that brought with it an enormous amount of pleasure, but it also brought with it a certain sense of what I call in that chapter foreclosures. Mm-hmm. What about other populations? How did they imagine themselves? And so when you think about someone like Charles Dumas, an absolutely brilliant modernist artist who has done some beautiful watercolors of New York cabarets, cruising scenes and parks, it's to sort of think about what happened with him when he was unable to participate in these scenes, and how he began to sort of reconsider a really negative and stigmatized vision of a space such as Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which, unlike New York, was not necessarily seen as a sort of epicenter of queer migration.
I don't know why. It's where I've always wanted to live.
I've actually met quite a few folks who've done a really good job of sustainable queer communities in the town. And so I'll send a shout out right now to Bruce Kellner, if he's listening.
Good. And it's funny, one of the reasons that I that when your book came, it just kind of piqued my interest was with us being here in Texas, we're in a big city, although what we call big city is not exactly what New York calls big city, in that I live like 6 miles from downtown Dallas, and my next door neighbor has horses, and and that sounds real stereotyped, like a ranch, but he has 3 acres, and and I'm 1 mile from a subway stop, but I'm right next door to somebody with horses and chickens and a rooster that wakes us up every morning, and it's kind of half rural, half very urban where I live.
Yeah.
The other thing about it here in Texas that recently, actually over the last several years, a lot of gay people have moved down to the Cedar Creek Lake area. Cedar Creek Lake is about 60 miles southeast of Dallas. Huge gay community down there, and about 2 years ago, one of the towns, Kemp, elected not only a gay mayor, but one of their 3 city council people that they elected as gay. Last month, the town right next to it, Seven Points, also elected a gay mayor. So, it was kind of like, if the first one was a fluke, when the second town elected a gay mayor, that's no longer fluke, that's a trend. It really is. I mean, what it is they found that, in one town, all of a sudden we have better government, and in our town we want that too. And really he was running against kind of a corrupt government that was there, and people voted for him. His being gay was, it wasn't even an issue in that race. It was, he can provide better government than the people who were there. In your discussion and studies of rural gays, do you find that to be accepted in these towns, rural gays are acting differently than urban gays are. Whereas in urban areas, we have our urban neighborhoods. I don't think the gay people who live on Cedar Creek Lake are moving into particular developments. They're just all over the lake.
I agree.
You're really hitting some key points that I try to work with. And also, I have to be honest, like sort of work through in the book, which is a sort of common stereotype that I think has been with us for several decades, that rural areas are by default homophobic and less hospitable to gays than urban areas. And the flip side of that coin is that the primary space for lesbians and gays is and has to be the city. And as your own anecdote just sort of, I think, delightfully revealed, that's adamantly not true. Mm-hmm. That in terms of history and just in terms of like recent anthropology, recent sociology, you're going to find lesbian and gay, transgender, queer populations all over the map. But it also brings to mind, in terms of trying to debunk those stereotypes, which is part of the goal of the book, another goal of the book was to sort of think about, or to kind of question, how do we really know what counts as a rural gay or what counts as an urban gay? Mm-hmm. And what do we mean when we use a phrase like rural or when we use a phrase like urban?
And that's exactly what I was pointing out with where I live. Yeah. I'm 5-6 miles from downtown Dallas, but I have horses next door to me. Am I urban? Am I rural? What am I, you know?
No, absolutely, absolutely. And so it kind of becomes, and this is a little gunky in terms of its theory, but it kind of becomes what a philosopher called a language game, mm-hmm. in which one person gets to define somebody else as urban, or one person defines somebody else as rural or non-urban. And with that comes a huge box, I'm trying to think of a sort of a toolbox, of certain stereotypes. And so I was interested in thinking about how certain rural lesbians and gays become identified with stereotypes of, say, backwardness or certain forms of crudeness or certain forms of unsophisticated or ignorance, and how they kind of played with those stereotypes to question certain forms of gay cosmopolitanism that you do find with A-list gays, not only in New York, but also in my current town of Bloomington, Indiana.
Mm-hmm. And how do you define it? You don't find that rural gays are crude and backward and all that?
Not for a second.
Right.
No, not at all. I think that it's difficult to define what you may count as rural gays. So I have to look at certain context-specific sites. So for instance, to go back to my first chapter, In Another Country, where I look at the paintings of Charles Demas, certain New York gays or certain East Coast gays in the 1920s and 30s would have seen Lancaster, Pennsylvania as a rural area or a rural town, mm-hmm. when, as a matter of fact, in the mid-1920s, it had a population of upwards of 22,000, which was pretty significant back then, mm-hmm. at a moment in America when rural and urbanized populations, so to speak, were kind of half and half. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of all depends on where you're speaking from, rather than sort of knowing where you begin with in terms of a rural or an urban identity. Mm-hmm.
You know, Patty here, it's great to have you on the show.
Hi, Patty.
Hi. You know, I think it's interesting. I find a real dichotomy in my experience as a native Texan, where I would think, well, folks who live in very small towns probably wouldn't come out. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, lots of people know, they just accept their gay neighbor or whatever. But my partner and I, in the middle, years ago, in the smack dab in the middle of the Bush administration, when they were really actively using us, you know, and for electoral votes, we were down visiting my sister who lives in a town down on the coast of Texas with about 2,000 people. And we went out to eat one evening, and of course my car has, you know, obviously I'm very clearly gay based on my bumper stickers, and progressive, you know, certainly. And we were eating at a restaurant, and it was really late at night, and it's a small town, and there was an elderly gentleman there with what we thought was probably his sister, eating not very far from us. We got up, left the table to go to the car. Here they came. They were parked right next to us. So he's walking with his cane, and he looks up at, at my bumper stickers, and he says, "I've been gay all my life, and I can't stand our president."
That's funny.
And here it was, we were just stunned. We were like, right on, you know? But here he was in a small town, and we assumed he lived in somewhere in the area.
Yeah.
And you know, he didn't have it. Hesitation one about saying, "I'm gay and can't stand that man."
You know, another one, who somebody who just recently came out, Shelley Wright, the country singer, who had so many problems coming out and blah, blah, blah. And I was arguing and did this on our newspaper blog and got attacked for it viciously.
And I'll do so.
Don't you get
I'll
attacked.
Do so now.
Don't you get attacked for everything you
do? I do, yes. But what my point was, or one of my points were, was that, you know, she was saying, oh, because of her background and where she's from and blah, blah, blah. And I was from New York. I grew up in New York. I've been in Texas for more than 30 years. But the rest of my family's from Alabama and Mississippi. And my point was, they're progressive, they're well-educated, and in New York City, I know people who are right-wing Republican. So just because of where you're from, you can't say, oh, poor me, I'm from blah, 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 and, you know, I just can't meet anybody at all. There are lots of people out there who are gay, who are progressive, who are educated, and I don't accept that argument.
You know, we're everywhere.
Yeah, we're everywhere. And, you know, maybe in New York City it's easier to meet other gay people, and you might have to look a little bit harder. But you know what? If you've decided that's where you want to live and there are fewer people there, you just do have to look a little bit harder. I think that's one of the main differences, not who the people are.
Yeah. And I think that, certain new media technologies, such as the Internet, have completely sort of helped transform that idea of, quote, the only gay in town or the only gay bar, in which certain forms of community and connection become easier to sort of facilitate via, say, an Internet or Facebook or other online sites. But going back to Patty's lovely anecdote, coming up, I grew up in a certain ex-urban environment outside of Birmingham, Alabama. And I was raised Roman Catholic. I was an altar boy until I was 19 years old and decided to head for greener pastures. And it always amazed me that in a very conservative Catholic church of a sort of ex-urban community in the Deep South in the 1970s and 1980s, there was always very welcoming of certain same-sex male couples who were clearly in relationships and had prominent positions in our church, yet they never exactly came out, as we sort of like to think of, I came out of the closet and you just nailed the door open. But they were nevertheless very accepted. And so the anecdote that, the theme that I take from this is that we shouldn't predict, as you rightly noted, David, that we know what any community will be like in terms of their relationship to lesbians and gays. Or people who just desire other men and women.
Right. And now, in defense of Shelley Wright, because I did plenty of criticizing, what offended me was that they used her shotgun in the mouth story as the story. It's what her publicist and her book company and everybody else who was selling her stuff used. And I actually read her book. And that's one page, and there are 240 other pages about other things. That's not what her life was. That's what her publicist knew could get her on the major talk shows. So, you know, part of that was, when I was talking about it, what I was really offended by was that they're holding that up as, you know, oh, poor thing, she had a shotgun in her mouth, and at that point, that's when she realized she could be gay. Well, she knew she was gay long before that, and she did lots of stuff. We need to take a break. We're talking to Scott Herring. His new book is Another Country, Queer Anti-Urbanism. Scott, stick with us. We'll be back in just a minute.
A hard time selling that old car truck, or just don't want the bother of selling it, the KNON Vehicle Donation Program can help. Just call 817-KNON-AUTO or donate online at knon.org. It's so easy when the tow truck comes to your home and picks up the vehicle. They give you the paperwork that you'll need and relieve the stress of what to do with the old car that won't sell. The number to call is 817-KNON-AUTO or donate online at knon.org.
And we're back with Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet. I'm here in the studio with Patty Fink. Scott, you still there with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Scott is the author of a new book called Another Country, Queer Anti-Urbanism. And, you know, one thing that I thought was interesting was that your book is published by NYU Press.
Yes.
How did that happen? You would think you would have looked for publishers anywhere and everywhere else.
God bless NYU Press and my editor, Eric, and Cara. The reason why I decided, it's a good question that you asked, to sort of publish with NYU Press is that the book is coming out of a series edited by two professors at NYU, Ann Pellegrini and Jose Esteban Munoz, entitled The Sexual Culture Series. And the series of books, it's probably about 20 to 25 books in the series, is dedicated to thinking about certain forms of queer studies, queer of color scholarship, thinking about questions of gay marriage and of lesbian and gay norms. And so I thought that the book, even though it was published by NYU, would be a really good fit for the main ideas of this series. At the same time, I also wanted to point out in the book, I have a line where I say there's a difference between living in a metropolis and living in a world of what a scholar calls, and I build on, metronormativity. And so I think that there's tons of folks in New York City and other major U.S. cities who can have really sustainable and rich lives, but that aren't necessarily forcing their lives or their norms onto those who live in non-urban environments. Mm-hmm. So that's why I thought it'd be a good fit with NYU.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so you actually chose NYU.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. It wasn't like, gee, I tried this one, tried that. Oh, okay, I'll try NYU. I just thought that was a funny fit. One of the publications that you talk about is one of the early gay publications. You know, there was, most people know The Advocate, most people know, you know, here in Dallas, Dallas Voice, Washington Blade, but you talk about RFD, which actually was one of the early gay publications, and it was published, where was it published?
It was originally published out of the Iowa Women's Press of Iowa City in 1974, I believe. And then it was published in various other journals across North Carolina and Oregon. And I was fascinated by this journal because of the ways in which it tried to reach out to, quote, country men and country women everywhere. At a moment when a journal like The Advocate was becoming a very, long may it live, a sort of very slick, glossy, that was becoming fairly consumerist. And I was interested in the ways in which certain DIY or do-it-yourself journals like RFD tried to create these communities of readers across America that were opposed to some of the consumerist ideals that The Advocate was proposing in the 1970s.
And when you say DIY, it really was. I mean, it was a Xerox sheet, basically. I love you have a map in the book, and it's labeled as RFD Country. Each dot is a known reader. Not each dot is 100 known readers. It's a known, and there were four here in Texas. Four non-readers.
I'm looking at that image right now, and I could never have decided. I love that image because it was such a it just sort of gave readers a general sense of themselves as sort of non-urban communities. But I also could never tell to myself to this day whether or not that image was tongue-in-cheek, because it seems like such a tongue-in-cheek map in many ways.
It does. There's a question mark for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Kansas. And Patty, it's on page 95. So I guess those are states where we don't know that we have a reader, but there were four here, but Nebraska had five.
I know Nebraska had five. My home state of Alabama had one.
Yeah, and that wasn't you.
It looks like there's some other folks up in Dahlonega, Georgia,
yeah,
and elsewhere. But RSD, to this day, thrives very strongly in terms of creating a community of readers across the globe at this point. But I wanted to sort of speak about that history of the radical fairy as it sort of splintered off of the rise of what's called gay ghettos in the 1970s, or these like dense concentrations that were developing. And a lot of people felt disenfranchised and disappointed by some of these quote-unquote ghettos,
mm-hmm,
across classes, races, and genders. And the printers of RSD were just one amongst the many, is one of my arguments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's still around, huh? RFD.
It is, no, and thriving very strong. A lot of my archive actually came from some really delightful and generous conversations from Sister So'ami at the Short Mountain Sanctuary, mm-hmm, in Liberty, Tennessee. It currently has a population of about 17 members who live there year-round,
mm-hmm,
but they have very regular meetings, which can draw upwards of hundreds of individuals to their gathering.
Huh. You know, and one of the things I think that you said that's interesting is it began, yeah, rural Iowa, and look, yeah, who has gay marriage now.
I know. It's a definite shift in many ways, in which and that's playing into this idea of rural areas are sort of hostile in some ways to lesbian, gay, trans, queer population. But it also, and you're hitting on something that I was also trying to work with in the book, is this weird equation between the rural and the U.S. Midwest or the heartland. And to think about ways in which a space like Chicago or Iowa troubles that notion was part of my goal in the book.
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to hearken back to the little town where my sister lives. My partner and I have visited down there many, many, many times. And my sister has a friend who we thought was gay. She's married. She's been married for 30 years, you know, and we kept saying, oh, I think she's gay. And my sister would say, oh, she'd be mortified if she knew you thought that, you know, because she's not gay. And we just thought about it for a while and kept listening and experiencing other people there. And Aaron finally, my partner Aaron finally observed, she's not lesbian, she's rural.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of rural women have that attitude, mm-hmm, that many, you know, lesbians have of self-confidence and just attitude.
I used to have a house down on Cedar Creek Lake, and you know, the older woman who lived across the street from us, she wasn't a lesbian, but if the fence needed to be fixed, she'd fix it.
Sure. I mean, it's that same sort of attitude, like, I can do what I need to do in life.
And if she wanted to get the boat out on the lake, she pulled the boat out on the lake, mm-hmm, because who else was going to do it for her?
See, she's not a lesbian, she's just rural.
That's an interesting story, because it also reminds me of, in the second chapter of the book, along with the radical rural fairies, they were very committed to thinking with certain lesbian separatist communes of Northern California, not based in San Francisco, but even further up. Mm-hmm. And there was quite a few lesbian communes that were very much self-sustaining, back to the land in many ways,
mm-hmm,
and adamantly refused to sort of identify with metropolitan-based gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And the rural fairies in the 70s actually used one of their DIY journals, Country Women, to develop their own magazine as well.
Mm.
There's really rich history to these stories that you're telling.
Mm.
Wow.
You know, another thing, we're joking about Iowa. That's where RFD magazine started, and now they have same-sex marriage. But if you think about it, all of the states that have same-sex marriage Yeah, Vermont. Vermont is a rural state. The biggest city in the state is
86,000.
I was going to say it's under 100,000. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So even the biggest city is a rural city. Connecticut, it's rural state,
New
really.
Hampshire.
You know, New Hampshire, rural state. Even Massachusetts, you get outside of Boston, it's really not an urban state at all. You know, so,
so you're making a case that, you know, the most progressive states in the country happen to have a large rural population.
You know, and not the most progressive states. Well, some of the most progressive states happen to have large rural populations, and it being rural doesn't mean that you are progressive, but being urban doesn't mean necessarily that you're progressive either. Look what California voted with Proposition 8. Texas, look how we voted. We have more top 10 cities than any other state. And New York doesn't, so look at where progressivism is coming from, and look at where acceptance is coming from. Is part of that just because in a state like Vermont, smaller population, very well educated population, they have, you know, lots and lots of colleges in Vermont. Is it that a state like Vermont, where you live in a smaller city, people are more likely to know their neighbors, and when you know your neighbors, you're less likely to dislike them?
So if I understand you right, you're talking about a sort of idea of a tolerance thesis.
Uh-huh.
In which if one is closer to, if a straight person is closer to seeing or to living around side like a lesbian or gay or trans person, then they'll be more tolerant of their life, quote unquote, of their lifestyle, of their way of living.
Yeah, because you know, if you live in New York and you're gay, chances are you live in Greenwich Village. There's a neighborhood in Brooklyn that a lot of gay people are living, Upper East Side. And I'm stereotyping that there are gay people everywhere in New York, but and there are, of course, there are. But you're more likely to live in a gay neighborhood and have less interaction with other straight people. But a town like Bennington, Vermont, doesn't have a gay neighborhood.
Yeah, it brings to my mind, actually, this wasn't part of my research, but it didn't make it into the book, but it talks about, in my epilogue, I talk about rural-to-rural migrations of Mexican migrants in the heartland, and I deliberately don't name where that is because of certain fears of U.S. enforcement raids. But there's a really interesting essay that just came out a couple of years ago in the Lesbian and Gay Review. I forget the name of the author. I'll get back to you maybe over the break on it. Called How They Do It in West Texas. And it talks about the lesbian, gay, and queer populations of, I believe the town is Odessa.
Oh, great. Correct? I used to live there for way too many years.
I've never been. I get to make a trip to San Antonio in the fall for the first time, so I'm excited about that.
Nothing like Odessa. Nothing like Odessa.
It talks about the really rich sexual cultures that are actually kind of under the radar in towns like Odessa. And we usually associate rich sexual cultures with places like New York City or Dallas or Atlanta or Chicago. But actually, the main argument of this essay is that you don't have to scratch underneath the surface that far to look at the ways in which certain lesbian, gay, and queer populations are actually thriving in spaces like Odessa, and that may not be as committed to an idea of, say, gay marriage that tends to operate on a much larger national level. And so that's just to say that in the most unlikely spaces, certain queer sexual cultures are thriving. And I wish that was my research for Odessa, but unfortunately it was somebody else's.
Oh, uh-huh.
But I think there's a point in that, though. And I'm not just, you know, just saying this because I'm living in Odessa. But
sure.
I think there's a certain level of, for lack of a better word, complacency that occurs in our community that probably needs to be studied at large, you know. And I think that might fall into that sort of community, such as in Odessa, mm-hmm. where there is a large LGBT population, and yet I've seen very little organizing, very little like striving to get a non-discrimination ordinance, for example, you know, some basic protections immediately where they live.
Mm-hmm.
But quite happy to move about and navigate their lives as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that not only in Odessa, but I see it in Dallas. Mm-hmm. I see it in Houston. I see it in lots of places around Texas, and I'm sure it's across the country, where we're happy where we are. A lot of people didn't even know that the sodomy law in Texas, 2106, that we've been fighting for years, you know, was gone as of Lawrence v. Texas in 2003. They're like, oh, no mm-hmm. big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. it's gone. And I think that complacency is one of the reasons we don't have equality under the law. We have equality as human beings, but not as under the law.
You know, one of the things you just said, Patty, was that, you know, they're not fighting for those basic protections. Scott, do you think that there is more basic protection, not under the law, just between people in a rural setting? The stereotype, of course, for hate crime comes from Matthew Shepard, which was rural. And James Byrd here in Texas.
Jasper's very rural.
Very rural. But most hate crimes occur in cities.
Yeah, and again, it sort of gets back to that sort of, what begins to sort of feel like a very, the word in my head is entrenched binary of rural equals dangerous, urban equals safety, mm-hmm. rural equals closeted, urban equals pride. And as you rightly point out, David, I mean, the minute somebody says Matthew Shepard, my head also goes to the outrageous and horrific bashing of queer of color artist Kevin Avian
mm-hmm.
in New York a few years ago. But it's a very chronic stereotype of imagining the rural as a space of danger. And it's a stereotype that's produced not only by non-academics, but also by certain academics as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I wrote the book, or with the book in mind, I wrote it, and I'm very curious about how you heard the tone of the book, but I wrote it for both general and academic audiences
mm-hmm.
To sort of critique my own kind without biting off the hand that feeds me, to be honest. I do need my paycheck.
And that's interesting that you say that, because as I was reading it this week, it goes back and forth between academic and just readable for, you know, somebody to just go through and read, and, you know, accessible to somebody who's not looking at it for an academic source.
Yeah, no, I hope that your readers and your listeners out there get a sense of that, because I meant the book to be actually readable in about an afternoon or like a day and a half.
Yeah.
And my model for it, actually, when I was writing it, was Comedy Central Roast.
Uh-huh.
If you see, if say Joan Rivers or Pamela Anderson.
Uh-huh.
And I was interested in trying to sort of roast certain stereotypes that we have about the rural, the urban, hence that sort of tongue-in-cheek title, I Hate New York.
Right. Yeah. And I love I Hate New York, and that comes right after, published by New York University Press.
So, you know. One of the many ironies, complexity of this little book.
Of all of our lives. Scott, we're talking to Scott Herring. His book is Another Country, Queer Anti-Urbanism. It is already published, right?
Yes,
yeah, okay,
it came
okay.
out on June 1st.
Okay, because sometimes we get books before their actual publishing date. But yeah, it is out on, I'm saying on bookstands. It is so hard, especially here in Dallas, to find anything gay in our gay bookstore closed last year. So, yeah, exactly. So look for it. Scott Herring, Another Country, Queer Anti-Urbanism. Scott, stick with us. We're going to take a quick break. Then we're going to come back with our quick one-minute feature, Those Darn Heterosexuals. I forgot to tell you about that, Scott. So just hold on as we're doing Those Darn Heterosexuals. Then we'll be back talking about more here on Lambda Weekly.
Thanks.
check out KNON's brand new website at www.knon.org. You can listen to KNON from anywhere in the world with our live internet broadcast stream. See the program schedule and info on all the DJs and formats. Find out about special events, upcoming benefits, and get advanced tickets online. Go to KNON.org and support great community radio anytime by making a pledge of support to the voice of the people. The all-new KNON.org.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
It's time for
Those Darn Heterosexuals. This week begins hurricane season. In 1998,
you're listening to North...
Oops. No, you're not. No. Anyway, go ahead.
This week begins hurricane season. In 1998, Pat Robertson warned the city of Orlando, "You're right in the way of some, you're right in the way of some serious hurricanes, and I don't think I'd be waving those Gay Days logo flags in God's face if I were you. Homosexuality," he said, "will bring about terrorist bombs. It'll bring earthquakes, tornadoes, and possibly a meteor." Then, 2 months later, 1998's first Hurricane Bonnie made landfall right near the Virginia Beach headquarters of Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network. Guess God didn't get the message.
Just because you robbed a bank doesn't mean you shouldn't be elected sheriff. But if heterosexual John White wins the race in Roundup, Montana, he won't be able to carry a gun because of his bank robbery conviction. And he didn't carry a gun in Mayberry, and it worked for him.
And contractor Billy Bobby Harrison, 24, was charged in Spartanburg, South Carolina recently with indecent exposure when he approached a homeowner, lowered his pants, and offered to pave her driveway later if she would just have sex with him. And that's this week's
Those Darn Heterosexuals.
Okay, we are talking to Scott Herring. His book is Another Country, Queer Anti-Urbanism. Scott, we were just talking before the break a little bit about hate crimes and... you know, the stereotype and how that really isn't true. Do you have any statistics on hate crimes and where they're actually occurring?
No, I don't, actually. Yeah. And in terms of, like, my own data, I work through a discipline of literary and cultural studies, and so I'm not a sociologist by trade. And so I'm more interested in thinking about how certain forms of art, like a book or a film or a painting, or, for instance, Alison Bechdel's just stunning graphic novel, Fun Home, a family tragic comic, which I hope you or your listeners have read, tries to sort of delve into these stereotypes of lesbian and gay rural environments.
Yeah, is Alison Bechdel a rural gay?
I don't think that Alison Bechdel would necessarily identify as a rural gay, but I do think that she's very interested in, or at least her book is very interested in thinking about what it might mean to be a rural gay. Mm-hmm. And so my last chapter is looking at the brilliant graphic novel Fun Home as it sort of presents a history of, and this is going to sound really strange, the queerest road in America, which is not Christopher Street or even Castro, but actually what I argue is Interstate 80, which was built in the 50s and the 60s, and it connected Christopher Street to the West Coast. Mm. And this highway was built right outside of Alison Bechdel's home of Beach Creek, Pennsylvania. And she actually talks about what that felt like for her as a growing lesbian and for her father as a queer man in the 60s and the 70s.
And tell us a little bit, what did that mean to her?
I think that she was deeply ambivalent. It's a very ambivalent book about what that meant to her growing up, as you might have read in the graphic novel. On the one hand, the road signified a sense of promise and of freedom. And she talks about this in these gloriously illustrated panels about how the, quote, anonymity of the city, and she's referring to Greenwich Village in New York City, might have enabled her father to live a richer or longer life. He died in the early 1980s as he was hit by a Sunbeam truck crossing Route 150 outside of the small town of Beach Creek. Mm. But at the same time that she looks at the promise that New York City might have held for her father, She also says, matter-of-factly, at the end of the book, that she can't imagine him anywhere else but in Beach Creek. And her father actually wrote her a letter where he says that anything that he discovered in New York City, he had already seen in Beach Creek as a young man, which gets back to an earlier point that I think we had all made, that we can't reinforce stereotypes about what may or may not happen in a rural environment.
Right. You know, that thinking about, and this is where I was going a little bit with the hate crime stereotypes, is with James Byrd's murder here in Texas, the half of the story never really got out. And one thing that I heard a lot of was, well, why did he accept a ride from these two white guys? Why would this guy have... And you have to know his family a little bit to have to understand that. He was raised, even though this town of Jasper is, you know, it's a small rural town, he didn't grow up hating anybody. He didn't grow up understanding or accepting segregation. If he was talking to some white guys, so what? So he took the ride. And it was nothing more than that. And his mother, when the gay community went to her and said, you know, we would like, you know, we could pass a hate crime law here in Texas, and we would like to pass it with protections for gays and lesbians. It would pass tomorrow if we took us out. And his mother's one question was, well, are gays and lesbians the targets of discrimination? And the head of our gay rights lobby said to her, you know, it depends on the year whether we're number two or number three. And she said, well, nobody should go through what my family went through. So, of course, we're going to keep gays and lesbians in this law.
And, in fact, it's the only law that that recognizes anything about sexual orientation in terms of protections in the entire state. It's the only law we have.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the kind of person she, you know, she's educated, she's intelligent, she's sweet, loving, warm. I love this woman, and that's a rural person. You know, that's my example of who rural Texas is to me. You know, she's just a great person, and I know lots of people here in Dallas, nice big city, who wouldn't agree with her, you know, who take exactly the opposite stand there. So, you know, again, this goes back to all of the, I wonder if more progressive ideas really do come out of a rural setting because people know each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as I can speak from own history of the office where I work, in terms of Indiana University in Bloomington, you can think about the extraordinarily progressive ideas of someone like Alfred Kinsey and a lot of his employees who canvassed parts of rural Indiana, rural Illinois, rural Ohio to sort of substantiate their claims about sex in the 1940s and 1950s. It goes that far back. And as I argue in another country, it may even go back further into the 1910s and 1920s.
Okay, now one thing I do have to bring up in Southern Backwardness, you have a quote here, and that's one of your chapters, and it is, given Meade's prior training in classicism, this should have come as no surprise. He once told a reporter, "My eye has been trained. I studied at SUNY Albany, and it's about as..." And Patty's going, "Oh, God, it's my school." Tell us a little bit about who Meade is.
Michael Meade is a Southern-based artist who I discovered and encountered in an Attitude magazine in 2000, and I want to say one or two, when I was doing my graduate work at the University of Illinois in Champaign. And he works across a variety of mediums, both painting and photography. But I was particularly drawn to staged photographs, not documentary photographs, that he had taken of certain rural-based subjects in East Tioga, Alabama. For those listeners who are unfamiliar, East Tioga, Alabama is fairly close to the Talladega 500 Speedway. And he documented the relationships between these men in East Tioga, Alabama, in the 1980s and the 1990s, in very fairly sexually explicit poses, some of them, Some of them are more mundane. Those would be certain, say, hunting or in a pickup truck. And they became fairly well reproduced throughout a variety of magazines like Out and Blue and Attitude, and also talked about on lesbian and gay chat rooms online, such as Data Lounge. And I was very curious about what these images, some of them which featured, say, the Confederate flag in the background, were trying to do or to say, or how they responded to certain ideals of New York City queerness, and how Mies was trying to record a certain form of queerness, if not gayness, and there's a difference between the two, that was taking place in Alabama. Kind of like the forms of queerness that I think may be taking place in Odessa as well.
And you know, Patty's looking at me like, See, she went to Baylor, one of the most homophobic schools in the country, and I went to a school where all of the famous people who came from that school are gay, like Harvey Milk and Gregory Maguire, who wrote Wicked, and you know. And here's here's another example, Patty. I just want to point out.
Well, Odessa has what was his name? Jim. He performed with Tammy Faye.
Actually, Jim Baker?
Not Jim Baker.
Jim Bullock.
Yes, Jim Bullock. Yep. He came from Odessa.
Oh, okay. You see? you have to look. You have to...
But, you know, I think part of that, I was just thinking about this as we were talking about, you know, dynamics, I guess, within a rural setting. If you know everybody, it's really tough to get in their face, and if you're comfortable and nobody's really actually discriminating against you, it would be kind of tough to force the hand, you know, to say we need some laws, we need elected officials, because, you know, the reality is that to actually accomplish that and get people elected sort of and organize is very long-term and very intense work. And, you know, to make that happen, and if you're content and everybody's not treating you very well and they know who you are, you may not talk about it. Mm-hmm. But they know you're gay and you're fine, then why rock the boat?
You know, and here's another thing, Patty. In small towns, small churches where, again, everybody knows each other, big cities, the trend really is mega churches, especially of those who are going to preach the hatred part of it. Did you do much studying of religion and how that blends into this? That it is rural religion somehow a little bit more tolerant, even the ones that are not, you know, open arms embracing, yeah, we're going to have same-sex marriages at our church, but still just somehow more tolerant?
I think, just going back to my own anecdote of a working-class Catholic church in ex-urban Alabama, that you certainly see forms of tolerance, but it may not necessarily be in terms of an out-gayness. There's a tolerance of, say, same sexuality, but in terms of, like, a certain outness, that may not always happen. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I would say that the best book on this, and he thankfully blurbed the back of mine, is E. Patrick Johnson's Sweet Tea, Black Gay Men of the South. Mm-hmm. And he does a lot of research in that book, a lot of oral histories, about the value, necessity, and permanence of gay and queer black populations in mm-hmm. North Carolina churches, and he sort of backed this up with ample history. Mm-hmm. Another really good history that I'd recommend for readers is John Howard's Men Like That, which also traces how churches were spaces of queerness, and in the Deep South, particularly in the Mississippi Delta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess where I was going with it was, you know, the rise of these urban huge churches, one of the ways they make their money is off of gay bashing, as opposed to smaller churches, which I think are more traditional, because traditionally being anti-gay, it just wasn't there. It's not like they were real accepting. It's just, it wasn't an issue. It just wasn't a topic. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something we talked about much one way or the other. You know, everybody knew the church organist was gay on some level, but
this is a sweeping stereotype.
Well, no, but and it is a stereotype. But you know what I'm saying. If not the church organist, the two gay guys who contributed something, you know, and they were part of the community as opposed to being the pariah of the community.
Yeah, and what I think is most important that I hope readers will take away from the book is that there's possibility, even though there's certain stereotypes that attach to certain geographies in America, there's sexual possibilities across the nation, mm-hmm. and that some individuals who, maybe because of socioeconomic reasons, haven't been able to, quote, pack up and move, they nevertheless create really sustainable lives. And I want listeners and readers out there to know that those lives aren't in any way diminished mm-hmm. because they may not be, quote, unquote, in a big city, and that those lives are extraordinarily rich, yeah. and there are beautiful worlds that have been created since at least the early 20th century to the present day by those who identify as rural.
And in the last census, they extrapolated some information. They found that there were like seven counties across the country that had no identifiable gay population. Is that what?
Three.
There were
Three counties in the entire United States.
Three with none, and one or two of those were the unpopulated West Texas counties that didn't particularly have straight people in them either. They're just large tracts of land with nothing. I wonder how the census is going to come out this time with, you know, what it's going to show.
It'll be higher for sure. I mean, they're actually, you know, providing a way for LGBT people to identify themselves in couples only.
Yeah.
Not counting any single gay people, and certainly no bisexual or trans or, you know, generally queer people.
Right, right.
Yeah. And just to sort of like to build off of both of that, as I sort of say this in the introduction, it's also really hard to trust a census number
sure.
in a lot of ways, because they tend to box people into certain categories. And it's the one thing that I sort of learned through all my years of doing lesbian and gay studies is that it's really difficult to categorize people in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to exceed the categories that something like a census bureau hits, which gets back to your earlier point, David,
mm-hmm.
about the horses in your backyard.
Right. 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 and it is hard to categorize. You know, where do I live? Do I live urban? Do I live, you know? We are out of time. Scott, I want to thank you very much. The book is Another Country, Queer Anti-Urbanism, just published last week. It is out by New York University Press. And here in Dallas, go to one of those bookstores and say, I want you to learn more of a gay section here, because you put Crossroads Market out of business, and now help us. Scott, thank you very much for being with us.
You're delightful. I hope you'll come on again.
All right, I would love to, and thanks both of you. Have a lovely day, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You too.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Alex, before the, you know, when we were trying to establish the phone connection, the first one didn't, and I said, okay, I was working on something this week. I did a really interesting, and I'm not saying the article's interesting, I'm saying that my interview with him I found interesting to do with, hand me my newspaper, right there, with Craig Holcomb, thank you, I'm completely blank, who's head of Friends of Fair Park, and he's been doing it for years and years. Craig really, from talking to this, and he can't come on because he does a Bible study class at his church this time of the day every Sunday. Craig is more responsible for developing parks in this city than anybody else, really. Just years and years, since 1989 when he went off the council. I just found that fascinating, you know, like $200 million that he and his organization have raised for the parks. And good for Craig. Thank you for
good
doing.
Good job.
Yeah, and thank you for doing what you've done. And it's. I wanted to mention it because it's a good example of a gay person in the city doing something that isn't a gay thing particularly, but we all enjoy. And I wanted him to come on and talk about it, but he can't. Because he does his church Bible study this time of day. Next week we have Gregory Pines on with us. Just talking about all the stuff that he does, and he's one of those behind the scenes, but not really. I mean, he chairs a whole bunch of stuff.
Gregory is a fantastic and fabulous man.
He is. So for all of us here at Lambda Weekly, we'll see you again next week.
KNON 89.